So today we're looking at the second really useful tool in the toolbox that the Buddha gave, that the Buddha suggested in order to change your mind. So last week it was ethics, this week it's meditation. And you could describe meditation as a method of working directly on the mind. So in a sense, ethics you might say is a bit indirect. We're through our actions, we're changing our minds because we're rewiring our brains in a sense. Well, in effect, that's what we're doing more directly with meditation. So there's a problem going back to the idea of the gap. So you have the experience of pleasure or pain, and then potentially the knee-jerk response of grasping the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. But can we just increase the gap between that experience of pleasure or pain and our response to it? So that's what we were looking at last week. And it's not easy, because sometimes that gap is really quick. You know, somebody nudges you on the tube and or cuts you off in traffic, and your response can be almost instantaneous. And sometimes the unpleasantness or the pleasantness can be overwhelming. So it's you're not left with much space, in a sense, to take a little break and bring a bit of awareness to the situation and consider what would be the best way forward in terms of the precepts. And also a lot of the time, if you're like me, a lot of the time I'm just kind of trying to work something out, or I'm a bit distracted, not totally present. So something happens and it's like my response, I have to rely on an automatic response because I'm not totally with it. So I'm not totally mindful. So it's not easy bringing awareness to the gap. But if we can, if you like, develop the awareness muscle, if you want to speak in terms of a metaphor. So meditation is the technique that we have available us to do that. So that's one way of describing meditation. It's a gym for developing our awareness muscle. So there are three main types of meditation. We'll go through each one of the three today, at least in our tradition, in the Triratna tradition. And it's probably true more generally, this classification that I've come up with of three different types. They are concentrative. Maybe I should write this down. Yes, you can read this. So Con, thank you. Bear with me a second and I will pop upstairs. So what we're doing in concentrative meditation is primarily training our ability to attend, honing that capacity we have to, if you like, direct our consciousness in a particular direction. A bit like shining a torch in a dark space. A lot of the time, we're simply responding to events happening in our environment. So it's not directed, it's kind of a bit haphazard. So you hear a sound and you look over there, or something catches your eye in the corner, so your attention goes there. Or more particularly thoughts, you know, a memory comes in of this morning and your attention goes to the thought, the memory. Or the prospect of meeting your boss later, that thought comes into your mind and your attention goes there. So it's you're immediately, all the time, just responding. and that's a bit haphazard. And really, when I stop, that is often the way my mind works. It's partly scanning my environment and looking for things of interest, whether it's sense experience, including thoughts and memories. So there's a problem with that. It's not a stable mind, if you like. It's not a concentrated mind. And we need to develop a capacity to be able to stabilize our mind. At least if we do develop a capacity to stabilize our mind so that we choose the object of concentration, then our mind can really calm down. And the body, it's like the body and the mind are so connected, then the body can go into a physiological state. The nervous system switches into a physiological state called the parasympathetic nervous system. So it changes the way our nervous system responds in this situation. And so that has consequences for hormones in our body. So, so for example, if you've got lots of demands on during the day, you're probably more than likely you've got adrenaline in your bloodstream. That's, you know, when demands are being placed on us, when we need to achieve tasks, and adrenaline is one of the main hormones that's injected, and that makes our heartbeat faster. We get more oxygen to the brain, to the heart, and obviously that was crucial when we were having to hunt. So the activities, really, the stressful activities, really required physical engagement. Mm-hmm. But also, it sharpens our senses. But we can't stay in that state of nervous system all the time. I think increasingly we are locked into that sort of adrenalized state, mm-hmm. Because of the demands placed mm-hmm. on us.
And society, I think.
But our nervous system is not designed, or we as human beings are not designed, we can't sustain that without doing damage. So there's this other state of the nervous system. So that is a sympathetic nervous system where we're responding to flight, fright, and fright, and also the strive nervous systems. Both of those are quite adrenalized. There's this other system, which is the parasympathetic nervous system, where there are these natural relaxants that are injected into the bloodstream. Like oxytocin is one of them. And so we can, in this state, we are relaxing, we're digesting, and our immune system is boosted. So there's enough, so the body is sort of sending a message to itself, yeah, I can relax now and I can repair. So it's kind of rest and repair mode. When you're in the highly adrenalized state, your immune system is suppressed because you need all the energy.
Yes, and did I hear or read somewhere, or maybe it was a documentary, but it's also like, that's also the digestive system as well, like your digestive system is suppressed when you're in the sympathetic and then parasympathetic, it's, yeah.
Yeah. So digestion is facilitated in the resting mode. Thing is, we're often locked into this adrenalized state. Mm-hmm. So when we can develop a capacity to concentrate, and the body responds by dropping into the more calm parasympathetic nervous system, we're actually boosting our immune system. We're giving the body a rest. We're giving our mind a rest. Where if we can really slot into that relaxed rest, repair, digest state, we're really doing our body a favor. What we're doing really is addressing the balance. Obviously, we're designed, all these states are good, we're designed to alternate between them so that you're not always kind of demanding a lot from your body. You're not always resting. If we don't challenge our bodies, our physicality, then we lose capacities. But if we can switch between the three main systems, one is the fight flight, one is the strive, and the other is the rest, repair, digest. So what we're partly doing when we are meditating in this particular form of meditation, where we're cultivating a concentrative state, where we are able to stabilize our attention. And of course, attention is crucial, isn't it? Because there's a whole multi-billion economy out there based on trying to grab our attention. Every time we go onto Facebook or something like that, our usage of media is surveyed constantly. And there are hooks created by artificial intelligence, which are very clever, so that they know how to hook our attention. They're all looking for our attention because that's advertising space. So what we attend to is really important. What we focus on, I think this is a truism, that what you attend to, what you dwell on, grows. So if you dwell on a hurt that has happened to you, that can just highlight and accentuate the sense of grievance. If you spend time thinking and enjoying the fact that something good has happened to you, well, that can just enhance your appreciation. So developing concentration is one of the first, at least, of the three forms of meditation. And we're developing concentration to be able to stabilize our mind, switch into the rest, digest mode, really relax, become more spacious. It's one of the techniques that techniques for busting stress in mindfulness meditation, that this is the main technique used. Then there's a second meditation type, which is, I'll describe it as a cultivative. And this runs with the idea that what you dwell on grows. So just as the nervous system, you know, has been evolved over the history of our species, there's also there's another evolutionary hardwired fact aspect of our minds, which is it's described as the negativity bias. And you can kind of get the idea that if in certainly our early days on the planet, if you notice the threats, if you give priority to noticing the threats, that's more favorable to your survival compared with noticing the pluses, the boons. Like if you miss the saber-toothed tiger,
because you're looking at the flower.
Because you're looking at the flower, or that lovely fruit on the tree.
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to be around tomorrow to eat the fruit on the tree. So your senses and your brain is biased towards noticing the threats as opposed to the treat. So that's the negativity bias. But of course, we're not in that situation nowadays. But we still have this hard wiring, if you like. So I don't know if it's your experience that you notice the things that aren't done well more. You know, if you're in a work situation, you notice, that job wasn't done well. Over and above appreciating all the great things that were done, or if something goes wrong in your day, you might dwell on the thing that went wrong rather than all the many things that went right, like the tube left on time, it actually arrived, or you found a seat, or there's so many things actually went well, but you perhaps focus on the one thing that didn't go. I don't know.
You can imagine. Yeah, it's really easy to do. Because I think we've all, like with work stuff, there's enough information that tells you to, you know, to try and focus. You know, we've been, you know, the work situation, you become a little bit more. You know, there's a much more awareness of the positivity and addressing the positivity with colleagues and all that sort of stuff. But with your own personal self, it really is so easy to focus on the things that went wrong in the day.
And that feeds a kind of self-criticism and maybe even eats away at self-confidence can be a corrosive thing. So the cultivated meditation is about, as the name suggests, cultivating positive mental states. So wishing oneself well, appreciating the things you have done well. And there are several variations. So the key theme within this is loving kindness. So really cultivating this positive mental state of loving kindness, which is a desire for the well-being of oneself and others. Even an ardent, you know, at its height, it's an ardent desire for well-being of oneself and others. It's quite simple, really. And loving kindness tends to be the word used, the English translation of metta. Metta, again, is the Pali, the word. So we're using these Pali terms because often the translations of them are not very satisfactory. Mm-hmm. So the dukkha was an example, and suffering doesn't really match very well. Metta, well, love doesn't quite work because it's usable as a translation of metta. But I mean, I love ice cream. I love buja chocolates. I love my partner. But that's a different. Each one is a different form of love, isn't it? Yeah. They're so wide. Mm-hmm. I love Pink Floyd music. They're all different senses of the word love. So we use love in so many different ways. So metta is quite precise. Well, it's not precise, but it's certainly narrower than your attitude towards ice cream and Pink Floyd and buja chocolates. So it's an ardent desire for the well-being of oneself and another's love. That's what loving kindness, that's what metta really is. So what we're cultivating is metta. So that's the second meditation we'll be looking at.
So say it again, metta, sorry, so because in my head, metta is...
So metta is an ardent desire for the well-being of oneself and another.
Right.
Loving kindness.
Right. Yeah.
And there are other meditations where... So what happens when loving kindness meets suffering in the world? Our own suffering or someone else's suffering? Then it becomes compassion. So it's a sense of wishing someone well, but within a certain context in which they are suffering. So it's adds a particular flavour to the well-wishing. When loving kindness meets somebody's good fortune, it takes on another flavour, this loving kindness. So if somebody's just won the lotto, or they've just got a promotion, and can you, sometimes it's not, it's a challenge sometimes, you know, because there's a bit of a thing, oh, I wish I had got that. But if you're able to just, celebrate that someone else's good fortune, then that's loving kindness meeting good fortune. So the loving kindness has a particular flavor. So they're the cultivative meditations where we're working on developing positive mental states based on loving kindness. So that's the cultivative meditation, and we will do one practice on that. Then there is contemplative meditation. in contemplative meditation, we kind of sit back in our awareness. So we have our experience, and it could be our senses, the sounds going on around us, the feeling of the whatever's supporting us, the contact between our buttocks and the chair. It could be maybe if your eyes are open, you might just have an experience of the cushions and the floor in front of you. Or it could be physical sensations in your body, like tension. Maybe you're feeling a pain in your knee or a tension somewhere in your body when you're sitting down to meditate. It could be emotional. You might have had a difficult phone call before the meditation, you're sitting down. And or it might be a judgment, you know, about yourself, someone else. Oh, I can't meditate. So what we're doing in the contemplative meditation is just being with that experience, being with our field of experience. So any one of those sensations, thoughts, judgments, might emotions might come in, and we just say, oh yeah, we just notice it. That's a thought or a regret. That's a judgment, and we just stay with it without need to comment on it. And what we'll see is that it comes and it goes. So the image is like clouds on a blue sky. They arise and they go. The experience, whatever the experience is, we'll find when we're sitting in meditation, when we quieten, we'll just notice that whatever happens comes and goes, arises and passes. That's the nature of our experience. We'd probably be surprised how busy our minds are when we stop and sit and do nothing. Probably be surprised how many thoughts crowd in one after another. The chattering, you know, the chattering mind, thinking about what happened yesterday or earlier today, thinking about the plans you've got set up.
It's all those little annoying things you think sometimes when you're trying to meditate. Why am I thinking about what I need to get on, you know, things on, you know, shopping list or something, stupid things. You're thinking, I find that, I'm like, it's not even like big important stuff, you know. Yeah. And like, oh, I'm worried about, you know, my friend has breast cancer. It's those bigger ones I find that I can bat away.
Yes.
Like, oh my God, I'm meant to be meditating. I'm thinking, literally, I'm going to use it the shopping list. Why?
Yeah.
Or did I lock the door, or, you know.
And the thing is, it's the way our minds work, because until we're really concentrated, our minds are scanning our environment, and that includes the thoughts that are available to us. So it's often when you sit down and stop, then the memories, I haven't done such and such a task.
Yeah.
Then bubbles up. But then the question is, what do you do with it? And that's the case with all these three meditations. The question is, what in that situation, what do I do with the fact that this thought has come up? And the discipline is to simply notice, okay, that's a thought, and not get carried away with the thought, not identify with the thought, not to believe the thought. It may be true, it may not be true. So you kind of get a little bit of distance from the thought, and or the memory, or the sensation, and you just let it be as it is. So you're not seeing the world as though through the thought. You're seeing the thought.
Right.
You see the difference. So you've got a bit of distance from it. You're not identified. You're seeing it. You're an observer. And if there's an observer, well then, you know, and the observer is saying, you know, okay, that's anxiety, that's fear. Well, the observer isn't actually anxious or fearful. They're seeing it. So there's some part of you.
Are we the observer?
We're the observer. There's some part of you that is not fearful and anxious. When you're observing what's going on in your field of experience.
That's interesting.
Mm. Now the technique that's used, as we'll see, in the first meditation, the concentrative, when you notice the thought or the anxiety, the technique there is, okay, we're training our attention. So what we do in that instance is we say, okay, interesting thought, thank you thought, not just now thought. And you redirect your attention back to whatever is the object of attention. And we tend, and we will in this meditation we're about to do,
mm-hmm.
we will use the sensations of the breathing as the anchor, if you like, for our attention. So we constantly bring the attention back to the anchor of the sensations of our breathing. Because you have sensations of with the movement of the breathing, the in-breath and the exhalation, that it might be in the belly, it might be in the upper chest, it might be in the throat, it might be in the nose.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use those sensations. They're quite, you know, you can get a handle on them. They're quite tactile sensations. And that's what makes them useful. We can constantly come back, okay? And the mind will distract you, the shopping list or whatever. And then you just notice and then say, okay, thank you, but not just now. Back to the attending to the sensations of the breathing. And you might have to do that many times in the meditation, because depending on how busy your mind is. But gradually, every time you do that, it's like a repetitive bringing the mind back, you are training the mind.
Mm.
So the training in the concentrative type of meditation is in that repetition of realizing I'm off on a train of thought, bring it back. A little bit a while later, off again, bring it back. Mm-hmm. Every time you come back, you are training the mind. And with time, and there's some effort involved, but with time the amount of effort decreases and you can reach a state of stable attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then that you can reach a state of absorption, a bit like maybe the absorption that a rock climber can get. They're so fixed on, you know, so present, they don't have to think. It's just there,
mm-hmm.
almost at one with the the rock face,
yeah.
Absorbed, concentrated. So that's kind of down the road. That's the.
It's interesting what you said, because I think I've never really had that explained, but I think what happens is, I'm just going to go back to the shopping list, is then what happens is it's almost like I find, thinking about what you said, I almost feel like it sort of invades me, because I'm like, the shopping list, and I'm thinking, I'm thinking about the shopping list, or you know, and then I'm thinking, oh, I'm getting cross at myself. Why are you thinking about the shopping list? And you know, you're meant to be doing that, and then it becomes a bigger thought, and then you're kind of getting, and then yeah, you're. So it switches just from a simple thought of the shopping list, I must remember to get, I've run out of that. And then all of a sudden it's like, and then you start to become personal, you know, so
if judgment comes in,
yeah,
I shouldn't be thinking about the shopping list, or you know, I should be meditating, or you know, if there's going to be a distraction, well, let it be you know, a friend who's really ill or something like that, but not this puny little petty shopping list.
And
so there's anger comes in then, and so judgment, and well, that's all a thought, that's all a part of our mind, that's all an event, and again we can just get some distance from it. So rather than the experience being up here where you're identified with it, you're seeing the world through it, it's like you take it back and you see the thought or the memory or the shopping list in context. You can see the backdrop, if you like. Okay, well, there are other things happening. It's not just this one thing that's going on. And you can also see the wider context of that's impermanent. Even your thought of the shopping list is not going to last that long. Something else will supersede it.
Mm.
So you don't have to give it too much importance. You can see it in the broader broader context, and that takes some of the power out of it. And once we cultivate this capacity to get a little bit of distance from our mental events, then we can come to the gap and be able to bring awareness to the gap, because we're not caught up, we're not overwhelmed, and we're getting a bit of perspective. So we're bringing calm to the gap, we're getting spaciousness, if you like. The secular mindfulness tradition talks about experiencing your mental life in a bigger container, where you're less identified, you've got more distance, you're less caught up with it, and therefore you can be creative. And then, so this is again, the chorus is break free, so you're able to bring a bit of choice into the situation. You can consider the alternative responses to, within the gap, the responses to the pleasure or the pain. But that gap is opened up, broadened through your ability to direct your attention, create calm, and create spaciousness around your experience.
Okay, so meditation then leads to, at another point, you being more aware or more mindful that when the pleasure, pain, stimulus comes up, you'll actually just naturally have that 1 second of, oh, I could react differently.
Yeah. Okay. You're cultivating mental habits. So it's like if a sports person will spend lots of time in the gym, so that's like their meditation space. Mm-hmm. But where it really matters is when they're running their race or throwing the javelin or whatever they do. So all the time training pays off.
Yeah.
So Buddhism would hope that your time meditating, mm-hmm, will translate into a different response. You're cultivating habits that are usable off the cushion, so
yeah.
that's what you're kind of using the gym to cultivate the skills, the habits that are useful for the rest of your day.
Yeah.
So that it doesn't just stay on the meditation cushion, whatever response whatever calm you're developing on the cushion, whatever spaciousness you're creating, whatever positive mental states you're creating. It's in order to be able to take that off the cushion and out into your day,
mm-hmm,
really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Meditation is a means to an end. It's not an end to itself,
mm-hmm,
in itself. And you could say the same about any and all of the Buddhist teachings. They're all a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And that end was
Enlightenment,
exactly. Yeah. Okay, let me see how we do time wise. Well, let's do a practice, which is the mindfulness of breathing. But as a preliminary, mm-hmm, to all the meditation practices, we need to consider our posture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, initially you may be meditating, or a beginner might be just meditating for 10 minutes. So you just need to have a posture that allows you to be able to be reasonably still, stable, comfortable, relaxed for 10 minutes. But maybe with time, you'll meditate for a half an hour. Some teachers recommend 2 periods of 40 minutes a day. I certainly don't get that in, but I aspire to. So again, we're looking to develop a posture which allows us to do whatever period of meditation we're aiming for. So it's good to start off with good habits around posture.
Mm-hmm.
And also they might translate into, you know, the rest of your day. You might be more mindful of your posture. So the key characteristics of posture, what we're looking for at least, are stability. We're looking for comfort. We're looking for so it's kind of sustainability. So if you're comfortable, and if you're stable, that they're related. You're trying to reduce the amount of muscular tension in your body. So that's how we're going to be comfortable. That's but in order to do that, we need to be stable. Really. So let's see. Let's start with the chair.
Mm-hmm.
So the key thing is to be well supported by both the chair, the base and the back, and whatever is there underneath. So that might involve changing the level. So that's why we have the cushions underneath. So, you know, we've all different lengths of legs. So ideally, you want your knees just to be ever so slightly lower than your hips.
Lower,
ever so slightly. Rather than up here, you want to be down there. It's a more stable posture with your feet flat on the. Yeah, so that's more or less either flat. The legs, the upper legs, either horizontal or slightly tilted towards the feet. And I mean, you could use something to lift the back just to get a bit more. If you don't mind, balance it on that. You could tilt your chair. Let's see. Does that work? There's a little bit more, perhaps, of an angle.
Okay, I could have also sat on something, I guess.
Well, that's obviously, yes, of course. Then you can. Now, I mean, how does it feel? Does it feel that you're... that wasn't so stable, was it? Maybe
really
if you
unstable.
Could bring your chair a little bit further so that it's on the... Maybe with the cushion, I think, but there are options, using a cushion or using a something behind the back legs. So as to get a stable, the key thing is to play with that and have a sense of what is stable for you. And you want to try and achieve an upright posture, so an upright spine. So rather than, you know, the two possibilities are hunched,
mm-hmm.
Or you could be putting pressure on the small of your back by coming back too far. So we're kind of looking for the spine being erect. Okay. Now sometimes it's good to use the back of the chair as your support, but just playing with the possibility of coming away from the back of the chair with an upright spine, again with your shoulders down by your side. So you're not doing kind of military chest out, but you're neither are you hunched. It's really interesting, the connection between the body and the mind. You notice people, myself included, when I'm lacking in confidence, I find myself like this. Or in meditation, if I'm really distracted, I'll often find I'm hunched, and then I notice that I'm distracted, and I almost feel this happens automatically. I just kind of pull back a little. As again, it's not a military, but I'm not so hunched. So it's like what's going on in the mind affects what's going on in the body. And the reverse is true. So if you lead with the body, then you affect the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good in terms of the setting. So the alternatives, you might want to try them, you might not. You can work with the astride position on a cushion. So that in this instance, I'm trying to achieve the straight back and the stability. So obviously you've got the stability on the chairs, you've got the erect spine. and play with it, I would say, you know, play with the idea of using the back as support that might be best for you, or it might be that coming away and just having an independent posture, independent of the back of the chair, see which works best. All of these are to be played with, really, see what works with for you, because we've all got different physiques, different strengths of muscle groups, and what allows us to have the stable, comfortable, relaxed, minimal tension in our bodies is going to vary for each and every one of us. Anyway, this is another standard meditating posture which allows you to have that stability. I've got four points of contact, and I can have a straight spine. Now, if you can play around with the height, for example, if I added another cushion, I've got more curve in the back of my spine, which feels okay actually. But if I didn't have enough, so if I took two of these, I'm going to struggle to have a straight spine and not curve my back.
Yeah, you can see that.
So you can see, kind of, again, you can play around with that. It may well happen if you do go for this that you find there's pressure on there, so you can perhaps sop something underneath just to soften the contact, the back of the feet. Okay, so that's the astride position. Then cross-legged, probably more classic positions for meditation. And that none of these positions are necessarily any better than another. In India, they go up, as I understand it, sort of on the floor. They don't have chairs are not as common as they are in the West.
Mm.
So, you know, and Buddhism has come from the East. So, that's one of the reasons that we associate the cross-legged position with meditation is because of where meditation has come from and the style of sitting. But you can achieve the stability in your posture with cross-legged sitting, if you so choose. So you've got, you know, your two points there, your sitting bones supported by the cushion. Again, you have to play with the height. So here, I think I need a little bit more height. This is semi-lotus. That's probably a bit better for me in terms of having an upright spine, not giving pressure on the back. And I've got the stability. And you know, with time, this used to have a bit of tension for me, particularly around here, but gradually I've got more released around here, so more flexibility in the hips. And this becomes a very relaxed posture for me.
Is that your favourite?
My favourite would be the full lotus, but I wouldn't go straight into the full lotus.
Oh.
I'd there's a series of yoga postures I would do
before you got there
to really get the flexibility,
yeah,
in the hips, and then do it. Because if I don't do that, I'll damage my knees.
Okay.
Because I'm stretching there rather than here.
Oh, okay.
And here is supposed to stretch that, the knee is not, is it, yeah. And if so many people damage, unfortunately, their knees, I mean, they are vulnerable joints,
yeah,
aren't they?
Mm. I'm very impressed with your hip flexibility, though. I'm going to probably sit cross-legged, but I can't do it.
I've been trying these sorts of exercises that you learn. You, I bet there's a name for this. It's something asana, where that really does work on these points. I can really feel it. If you're gonna do the cross-legged. Again, you're looking for the stability. So,
what you probably should do is support your needs. And check to see if you can get the straight spine, because often the general recommendation is that your knees are below your hips.
Oh, I see.
That's the general recommendation.
Yeah.
So you can see I've got enough flexibility to do that, to get the knees
below your hips.
Below the hips. Mm. But we're all different. So the question then is, does it feel like your spine is straight in that posture? I mean, it's looking fairly straight to me.
Mm.
And your shoulders are reasonably...
Well, this is comfortable, but I don't know if I'm particularly straight.
I mean, it looks
pretty
straight to me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's working for you. So I think, you know, you hear generalizations like your knees should always be lower than your hips, but actually, we're all different. And if you can achieve those basics of stability, straight back. A straight back really helps with alertness.
With what?
Alertness.
Okay.
Again, it's you know, we know the difference between how it feels between being hunched and being open-chested. And there's something also about, you know, so again, psychology and body are so connected. Confident person often is kind of like this, open to the world in a way. Somebody who's less confident is kind of closed in. And there's something about this posture which I like, which is the openness of it. There's kind of an open chest, this open hips potentially. And these can translate into psychological states, so a sense of openness of the mind in meditation. Okay. So, let's see how we're doing. Why are the knees?
Why are the hips meant to be above
the
knees?
What's the
reasoning?
I think it's some sense that you can't have a straight back if the knees are above the hips.
Okay.
I think that's my sense of it. But as far as I can see, you have a straight back. So as far as I can see, you fulfill the.
No, because I was thinking, like, wouldn't some people just meditate on the floor rather than without a cushion, and then surely your hips would be in line with your knees, or
yeah,
at the very least.
So like this.
Yeah.
Yes, most people actually, most people, if they meditate like this, have got a curved spine.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
As far as I can see, when I see people who don't have the support underneath. It's interesting just to notice when you see people meditating, and if they don't have the right level of support for their sitting bones, often they're kind of curved. But you don't want to have it too high, such that you're really putting pressure at the back of the small of the back in particular. You want those vertebrae to be reasonably open. Again, it's reducing the tension in the body. So the principles are fairly straightforward, I think. You know, reducing tension, having stability, erect spine to promote alertness. And if you follow those basic principles, you can develop a fairly sustainable, comfortable, relaxed posture.
So why not lying down? You go to sleep.
Some meditations are actually recommended to be done. There's a body scan meditation which, you know, helps you just really be present to your different parts of your body.
Start
with the toes and finish with the scalp, or the other way around.
Yeah.
And there's more of an emphasis on really relaxing and dropping your weight. The danger is, if you're in any way tired, had a busy day, you didn't have a great night's sleep the night before,
you fall asleep. And that's fine, certainly in any meditation sessions that I'm leading, that if someone falls asleep and starts smiling, that's fine, because that's what they need to do. You know? That's, but it's...
You just don't want to be that one, though.
With a giant snore.
Yeah.
Or when you've done it yourself and you've gone... You're going to have like this up. Like tiny moment thinking, oh my God, that was me. That snort. And then it's always bigger in your head and no one else's. No, just it.
So, yes, I mean, you can try. Again, it is a question of experimenting with all of these positions. So some people might not be prone to falling asleep when they're horizontal. I think for a lot of us, we've got these almost programs, you know. When I'm horizontal, that usually means one thing. I'm in my bed and it's time to go to sleep. So that sends a message. I'm sure there are messages going in there to my brain. Yeah, it's time to go to sleep. So it's in the middle, if I lie down in the middle of the day, my head is probably, oh, maybe it's time to go to sleep. Maybe it's time for a cup of tea.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And we'll come back and do the mindful, the first of the three meditations. We'll do the concentrated meditation.
Okay. How long are we going to do it for?
10 minutes. And then we'll check in how it went.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do a cultivative and a contemplative.
Great.
Meditation. So tonight's having given the kind of theory that is pretty practical.
Yeah.
So, a practice of the mindfulness of breathing. Maybe I'll just describe it first before we actually do it. I'll just make sure I keep an eye on the time. So, yeah, the focus, the anchor for our attention, it's as a concentrative technique, it's very much about using the sensations of breathing as the anchor. So we intend, or we set our intention at the beginning to focus our attention on. So we set our intention to attend to the breathing, the sensations of breathing. But we're all human and our minds are busy and we will get distracted. So we intend to notice that as soon as possible, notice the distraction. Okay, I'm off with planning tomorrow, something that's going on tomorrow. And we just think, fair enough. And without any judgment, without any criticality towards ourselves, that's a key ingredient. Mm. Just understanding that's the way my mind works. All our minds work. So with kindness to ourselves, we bring our attention back to the anchor, the sensations of breathing. And then you'll get distracted again, and you'll bring it back, get distracted, bring it back. So it's by dint of repetition of bringing back, you're kind of training the mind, you're sending a message to your subconscious mind, this is what I intend to do in this practice. So you're gradually cultivating a stable attention, and as I say, the consequence of that pacifying the mind, calming the mind, potentially really coming into a very relaxed parasympathetic mode of the nervous system. So we find the posture that works for us, wherever we're at. Stable, upright spine. And it's worth spending some time just getting that. Quite an important part of the practice, particularly within Zen Buddhism, there's a huge emphasis on the posture. Getting the posture right. So we just notice how it feels to be in our posture. What I didn't mention was it's useful to have the hands supported such that you can just allow the arms to drop and the hands to rest dead weight. You don't want the weight of your hands or arms to become hunching you forward. Again, same principle, we're trying to keep an open chest. And so, settling into the posture. And it is often good to start by really arriving, particularly if you've been busy, arriving through the senses. You can open your eyes, have your eyes open or have them closed. If you have them closed, there's less opportunity for distractions. But not everybody feels comfortable with having their eyes closed. You can do it with eyes open. So, closed eyes if comfortable. And tuning into the senses. The senses only ever are in the present moment. Whether it's the hearing. So you might begin by just tuning into sounds in the space you're in, bumping on the floor, footsteps on the floor, doors opening and closing, maybe traffic or bird song. Just noticing the sounds and letting them arise and fall. And then you could go through this several senses, you know, this sense of smell, just noticing any aromas. And depending how busy your mind is, you might spend more time doing that, just arriving in the present moment through the senses. My brain taste in what's, if you've had some food recently. Still some residual tastes. And the sense of touch. So what's registering to your sense of touch? Might be the temperature on your skin, on your face. Might be the contact between your clothes. Might be the contact with whatever is supporting you, the chair or the cushion, the mat, the floor. Just noticing the pressure of those contact points. So by focusing on the senses, you're dropping out from your mind, from your thinking mind, into the body, into the here and now. Then the invitation is to tune into your breathing, the inhalation and the exhalation. Specifically the sensations of the movement of the inhalation, exhalation. So first of all, where do you notice the inhalation and exhalation most? Might be in the nose, or the throat, or the upper chest. Abdomen. So whatever point you've chosen in your body. sensations are most prominent? Set the intention to attend to the sensations at that point. The sensations of the in-breath and the out-breath. Curious, bring a quality of curiosity to your noticing the breathing cycle, as though you're coming to the sensations of breathing for the first time. Rhythm. Thought. Well, that's totally natural. It's what our minds do. Just notice that's what's going on. Is that any self-criticism? With understanding? And bring your mind back to the sensations of breathing. Okay, so at that point, you feel the sensations most. And if you find your mind is really busy and constantly heading off on trains of thought, it might be useful to use counting to support your attention on the breathing. So you can, at the end of the out-breath, you can count 1. Stage you get distracted, just notice and start from 1 again. And then you can see how many breaths you get to before you get distracted. It might be just 3, it might be 5, but in a sense it doesn't matter. As long as you notice you're distracted and you come back. Some people What happened for you? Did anything?
Lots of batting away of thoughts.
Right.
Yeah.
And were you able to be kind to yourself?
Yes, you that were. Changed. Yeah.
Right.
Because I think before I ever knew that, I would have gone into. I did look like a lot of times. Come on, stop! But not as bad as I had previously.
Mm.
Yeah. And that was helpful.
Good. Mm. Sometimes that phrase, you know, okay, hello thought, thank you thought, not just now thought, goodbye thought, so some kind of sequence like that, which is very it's not suppressing. There's an attitude conveyed through words like phrases like that, which
mm-hmm.
you're not pushing down the thought, you're saying, okay, I'm doing something else now, just hold off for the time being. So it's
mm-hmm.
not a, you're not slapping down on the thought. It's more, you can bring a bit more of a sense of gentleness into the, not just now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that useful because I think I had sort of hard to explain similarly, and I don't know, I guess what kind of meditation it was, but like just let the thought come in and then
mm.
kind of let it go. Mm. Whereas I feel like when you're told to, have all the thoughts leave your head or clear your mind.
Mm.
I'm like, oh no, it's not clear.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's like, oh my god, so much stuff.
I was really afraid I might fall asleep.
Yeah.
That was my fear in a meditation. Mm. And so I think sometimes I would be like, oh, am I just getting good at meditating? Or am I not thinking about anything? Oh my goodness, am I asleep? That was my slight anxiety.
So that's an emotion, isn't it? Fear of falling asleep. So you can notice, fear of falling asleep.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh, I feel like I might be getting into this now, and then the fear of falling asleep would come back. But also lots of like random thoughts, some relating to. The weekend and next week, but not so much of like, oh, I must do this. It was more like, oh yeah, that was quite nice. Oh, we're gonna do that. And then a very like random one popped up from like something I probably would have been doing like 5 or 6 years ago. That's just like a flash, an image popped into my head and popped out, and I have no idea where that came from. Not a bad thing, just like very random that it would have popped in. It has no, there's been no connection with, yeah.
When you allow a little bit of quietness, and as you, the sense that you know meditation is about stopping your thinking, you'd want to be an incredibly experienced, skilled meditator to do that, and I'm not sure why you would particularly want to do that, but it's very much more about okay, knowing what's going on really in your head. Whether it's the fear or the thoughts of the shopping list or whatever, or that experience which you know sometimes memories come up for me from 5 years ago or 20 years ago, and it's like I haven't thought of that in all that time, and why has it come up now? So you there's a sense of when you do at least still the mind, not stop, but when you do still the mind. It gives an opportunity for stuff just to bubble to the surface. And in this meditation, the spirit of the meditation is you, rather than getting all excited about that memory and remembering the context or the people involved, again, you do the same thing. You say, hello thought, not just now thought, goodbye thought, and you come back.
That's a good one to remember, not just now, hello thought, deal with it, and then, I hadn't heard of that either.
It's all trying to pull back from the thinking and not seeing the world from the thought, not identifying with the thought, just getting a bit of distance from it, so that you're less caught up. Well, let's try the second type of meditation, the cultivative type. So there's I mentioned that metta is the name of loving kindness in Pali. Mm-hmm. So there's a meditation called the metta bhavana, so that bhavana means cultivation. So it's the cultivation of loving kindness. So we'll try that. Often this is done in five steps. The key aspect of it is well-wishing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like coming at loving kindness from the side. You can't make an emotion happen. You can't say, I'm going to love this person.
Mm.
I'm going to, any other emotion you can think of. I'm going to be calm. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be calm now. I'm going to be, you know, through gritted teeth, I'm going to be calm now. Emotions only arise on the basis of conditions. So if we create the conditions, then the emotion can arise.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like being a gardener. You know, you can't force those plants to grow. You water this. You plant the seed, you water it, you let the sun in, you make sure the soil has enough nutrient, and then the plants will grow. So what we do in this metta bhavana practice is we use well-wishing to cultivate, to provide a condition on the basis of which loving kindness can arise, well-wishing, the emotion of well-wishing. So your focus is very much on well-wishing, which is kind of something you can do. You know, even someone you don't like, you can wish them well, potentially. So it's not so much depending on an emotion, it's just a wishing. So metta, loving kindness, has these two sides to it. One of them is the emotional side.
Mm-hmm.
The other, maybe what we think of more when we hear the word loving kindness. But the other aspect of it is the well-wishing. So I think I defined metta as an ardent desire for the well-being of another. So in the practice, we focus on the well-wishing, and with time the loving kindness will arise, like the plant will emerge. So maybe we just dip into it. So that's the background behind the metta bhavana. And often, as I say, it's five stages, we'll just do three. And we start with ourselves, then we bring in a friend, and then we broaden out from there.
Are you going to talk this through?
I'm going to talk this through.
Okay.
And there's a sense we start with ourselves because, you know, unless we have some... You can't give what you don't have. You can't... Give soup from an empty bowl. So we start again, finding our posture, stable posture, relaxing, sinking into the posture, if you like. But holding the upright spine, holding the shoulders broad. Focus to start with on ourselves, and we wish ourselves well. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering. We might use other phrases, may I be fulfilled, may I be at ease. Repeat these phrases over and over like a mantra. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering. Or you might use visualizations like? You might imagine yourself in your favorite place in the world. And the sense of well-being that you conjure in imagining yourself there. Wish that for yourself. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering. Again, if you find yourself distracted, that's totally natural. Just notice, and without any self-criticism, just bring your attention back to that well-wishing. May I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering. Second stage, we bring to mind a good friend and we make them as vividly present to our mind as we can, maybe imagining their face, their voice. And we can bring to mind some of their good qualities, maybe their sense of humour, generosity. Maybe we have memories of particular instances when they've done us a favour. And we wish them well. we begin to expand our well-wishing, maybe beginning with the shrine room space, let each one of us here be well and happy and free from suffering. Centered in people above, centered in the flats. May they be well and happy, free from suffering. So we might not know these people or anything about them, but we know they are fellow human beings. We want to be happy just like we want to be happy. And they have similar joys and sorrows to our joys and sorrows, and we can wish them well. In our lives, may they be well and happy, free from suffering. Continue to expand the range of our well-wishing, moving out onto the streets of Bayswater, pedestrians, people in cars, in offices, shops. Restaurants. You might like to imagine our well-wishing a circle of light spreading out from here across London, including more and more people, wishing them well. May they be well, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering. Continue expanding across the country, across the sea, across the continent, taking in more and more countries, people in places of war, people in places of peace, the ill and the well, the rich and the poor. Free from suffering. Until you come to wishing all beings on the planet well. Wherever they are, may they be well and happy, free from suffering. is your experience of that?
I found that one quite hard, actually. Yeah. Was it okay on the very first bit, but as it kind of grew, I found it really difficult to, and I started to get distracted. I mean, I haven't really done that much in meditation, full stop, so it's probably quite a lot to kind of do the first one and the second one.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering if I'm a bit twitchy as well, whether or not I should leave the third one and maybe call it, because I'm just not, you know, I feel like I'm not.
Sure.
Like it's been a bit, almost a bit too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. If that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
I just found I got a lot out of the first one and then just was, I was okay for the first bit,
sure,
and then
yeah,
I just,
yeah.
yeah.
But then just notice
yeah.
that you were more distracted.
Yeah.
And that's, you're actually doing the meditation just by being aware, being mindful of what is happening. So it's, so it's not like you're not succeeding. It's once you sit down and are aware of what's going on, even if that is not, if you like, following the so-called program,
you are
meditating.
Oh, okay. That's a good thing.
That's the beauty of mindfulness, really, is that you can't get it wrong, in a sense. You can't do it wrong. Once you're being aware, once you're being present to what is actually going on, that's fun. Because it's not like you're supposed to follow a particular schema.
Right.
Because your experience doesn't follow a schema, does it? Your experiences.
I think when you pick it up generally out there in the world, you know, like when you hear it feels like it's meant to be, that was really helpful, because it feels like it's meant to be, you've got to kind of meditate for 10 minutes, you know, or it feels like it's going to be a program, but as you said, just...
And this is the radical nature of meditation. Most things we do, there's a yardstick against which you measure the progress of the event. But with meditation, the whole point is just to be present to your experience, and that's going to change. So you can't predict what your experience is going to be. Like.
I really enjoyed it, actually. I think that having those words and having something to kind of concentrate on other than breathing were quite helpful for me.
Right.
So I, in the first section, I think that my mind wandered a little bit onto, like, again, very kind of like random thoughts. But I think maybe engineered, because you said, like, imagine a happy place or... did you say that?
I did.
You did,
yeah.
I was on lots of different beaches, and somewhere in Australia, so I was like, that's obviously that connection from upstairs. And I think I was aware of that. I was like, oh, this is why I'm thinking about this. Then the next one, someone else, I thought that was quite nice. Like, the person that popped into my head wasn't necessarily who I thought would pop into my head. And then the stretching out, I don't know, I think I quite like visualization, so I just kind of imagined little like energy beams, like going places around Bayswater and then to the world and to animals as well. I decided to include those.
I was going to mention the possibility.
So I enjoyed that one.
Good. And again, we're all going to be different in which meditations work better for us in terms of really being present. So we won't do the third.
I was going to say, do you want to do the third and then?
Are you happy to?
If I leave, then you can do third. Is that okay? Or should I?
What I could do is, in a sense, the third is incredible. I could describe what to do, and it's part of the practice.
Okay, but I don't want you to miss out.
Well, in a sense, you won't, because I'll describe what to do, and it will be. It's very, very simple. It's really being with what your experience is. So you kind of pull back from any effort to concentrate on your breath or to wish people well, and you just notice what's going on. And it could be sensations in your knees or elsewhere. It could be a sound that's happening around. It could be tension in your body. It could be judgments going on. I'm not good at meditating. It could be just if your eyes are closed, kind of what's going on against the closed eyelids. So, it could be internal, external thoughts, judgments, anything. Just noticing that's what's going on. And the image is, it's like clouds in a blue sky. They just arise and pass, arise and pass. And that's what you'll notice in the meditation. Whatever the experience you've noticed, it'll just arise and pass. The sound, it'll come, it'll go. And what we're trying to not do is get into a train of thought about the sound or about the sensation, just to hold back in our experience and just notice the arising and the passing, the arising and the passing. So that's really the simplicity of the third. Mm. So it's kind of open. It's not so easy to guide in a way because of that. It's really just a question of saying, there are various images in guiding it. There are various images you can bring up. You can say, just see the experience, whatever it is, that itch on your nose. Just notice it and see it imagine it as a leaf on the surface of a river. Just pass by. Then something else will happen. Maybe the itch will transfer to your neck. So it's a more open, free-flowing kind of meditation where you're just trying to avoid the heading off on distraction. But if you do get into a train of thought, well, then that's your experience in that moment. And you just say, that's what my mind is doing. And then you're back, you're in the flow of the experience then, because you're noticing that's what is your experience. Does that make sense?
Total.
And just noticing whatever is going on.
So you're not, there's no anchor, so to speak. You're not bringing it back to your breath or bringing it back to a mantra. You're just closing your eyes and seeing what happens.
What happens. And noting that, observing that.
Mm.
Rather than getting caught up with it, you're observing it.
Okay.
That's the crucial difference, really.
So you're sort of going, it's interesting, my mind went there. But then you just keep following it?
You just watch it arise and it'll pass.
Oh, you let it pass.
And something else will come in,
okay.
Will take its place, and just notice that, And it could be, the new thing that's coming in could be, I don't get the point of this. And then you just notice, my thinking, that's what's happening. That's my experience. So it could be a thought, could be an image, could be a memory, sensation in the body. So the invitation would be to do that as part of the home practice.
Because
it can be unled.
That sounds good.
And maybe do it for 10 minutes. Try that for 10 minutes. Just sit down, no plan, nothing to do apart from do nothing. And notice what arises in your experience in the doing nothing. So there's no goal, really.
Mm-hmm.
It you could say that there is a goal, which is just noticing whatever is happening in your experience. And one other thing, so that's the first part of the home practice. The second part would be to choose some activity you do on a daily basis. It could be like brushing your teeth, doing the washing up, walking the dog, and really be present to it. Notice, because we can brush our teeth and multitask, can't we? Or making the cup of tea. You know, you can be talking to someone. You can be thinking ahead, because it's something, it's an activity you do often, you actually don't need to attend to it. So the idea of this practice is to attend to some activity that you don't need to, because it's so automatic. So really be there in the activity, noticing the sensations as the brush meets your gum, noticing the taste, really being present to the sensations that are happening while you're doing it. So it's very much following the concentrative type of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You're deliberately attending to what's going on, your sensations during that activity. So it's a concentrative activity, but it'll illustrate the fact that, you know, it's not just when you're on your cushion that you can bring this into play, but actually when you're doing a very mundane task, which you could do on autopilot, and we do a lot, let's face it, we do a lot on autopilot. I mean, I leave the house and sometimes I'm halfway down the street and I wonder, have I locked the door?
Mm.
Did I blow out the candles?
Mm.
Did I switch the heating off? And I go back and I've done all of those things, but I did them all on autopilot.
Mm. You've got a specific memory of it.
Yeah. Because I can do them automatically. So we don't actually turn up for a lot of our life when we're on autopilot.
No. Yeah.
So mindfulness is very much about really turning up, being there in our senses. And if we're doing that, if we're turning up and being in our senses, we're not locked in into the working things out in our heads, which can be very stressful and can keep us in that adrenalized frame of mind. Well, actually, that's the time. 21:31. Thank you very much.
Do you want to hand putting this away?
If you've got time.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. If we put the chairs up against the wall, and you can see where the other bits go. It's all like with like.
Can I ask very quickly what were the mantras that you said in that meditation?